Hello, and welcome to our program, Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First off, your true stories. Readers share the most clever, hilarious, and moving ways someone has let them know they're loved. Reader's Digest readers contribute, "Love is a hoot," in Reader's Digest. First, from Brenda Walsh of Avon, Ohio. My boyfriend and I were carving pumpkins. After carving a lid, I found that mine was already hollowed out with a diamond ring inside. I was thrilled at his proposal and flummoxed as to how he pulled off placing the ring box in my seemingly untouched pumpkin. Years later, pumpkin carving remains a favorite, and my husband's trick a mystery. From Elkridge, Maryland, here's Elise Dassing. My husband and I try to maintain a sense of humor about our shortcomings, like his refusal to admit he has a hearing problem. While driving along the highway one day, I read a roadside exit aloud, Harleyville. He turned to me and said, "I love you too." It's become an inside joke between us. Instead of "I love you," we just say Harleyville. From Berlin Heights, Ohio, here's Amy Mingus. My boyfriend, Dean, had a stroke at age 47. He needed therapy to use his arm and leg again. He was tired and depressed, but I encouraged him. One day, he stumbled while we walked down the hallway. I helped him straighten up and we continued. He sagged again, but I wouldn't let him fall. The more he seemed to be sliding down, the more resolved I was to help. Finally, he said, "Will you please stop holding me up? I'm trying to get on one knee and ask you to marry me." We have been married for 11 years. From Claire Jones in Overland Park, Kansas, I stepped away from making my turkey sandwich for just a moment. When I got back, my husband had added the mustard for me in the shape of a heart. It wasn't some grand gesture, but 9 years later, I still think about it and smile. From La Quinta, California, here's Richard Hauser. For my wife's 50th birthday, I signed 50 birthday cards and mailed them to friends and relatives all over the country to mail back to my wife on my behalf. This way, she'd get a birthday card postmarked from all 50 states. My son drove from Oregon to Washington to have one postmarked in the Evergreen State. I even enlisted a few Holiday Inn managers. From Wauseon, Ohio, here's Mary Schultz. Early in our marriage, my husband Bill and I worked different shifts and seldom saw each other. We'd leave notes to communicate, addressing each other and signing off with just our initials. One day, I came home to find our pond frozen and M, I love you, B, written in giant letters on the snow. I was touched by the sweet message and imagined the work it took to shovel out each letter. After 18 years of marriage, he is still the love of my life. From Cricket Lot in Lansing, Michigan, my husband once got me a credit card-sized I love you greeting card. I hid it for him to run across. He returned the favor, and we've now been hiding it back and forth for years. Sometimes it stays hidden longer than others, like when he hid it in the pocket of my fleece jacket at the end of winter. From Grove City, Ohio, here's Michael Flavin. I wrote a letter to my wife, Patty, every day while I was deployed. I signed each of them, Patty, I love you, Mike. Sometimes I'd abbreviate it to P-I-L-Y-M. Once home, I had to buy a new vehicle registration. I chose a custom license plate that reads P-I-L-Y-M, which makes her smile every time I pull into the driveway. From Indio, California, here's Joan Helms. I was attending a jump meet with several other skydivers, including Jerry, whom I was dating. When we jumped from 6,000 feet, Jerry grabbed hold of me and gave me a kiss, known as a kiss pass if you do it while free-falling. I knew it was his way of telling me that he loved me. We got married 4 months later. From Menominee, Wisconsin, Brenda Pyle writes, "When our daughter sent out her wedding, quote-unquote, save the date cards, she accidentally addressed ours to dad and guest. My husband, the jokester, quickly lined up two other women, both A-list actresses, to take before asking me, his wife of 30 years, as his third choice. I told him it would take a grand gesture to get me to be his date. We joked for weeks until I came home to roses and a letter detailing all the reasons he loves me and asking if I would be his date. It was a beautiful wedding. Shame those actresses had to miss it." And finally, from Loganville, Georgia, here's Janice Smith. "My husband, Larry, was excellent at giving unique gifts. One Christmas, he gave me 100 daffodil bulbs of all kinds and colors. It is my favorite flower, tied to special memories of my grandmother. However, I have a black thumb and thought, oh no, am I going to have to plant all of these? Reading my mind, Larry assured me that planting was part of the gift. He planted all 100 bulbs all over our yard, and they blossom into a beautiful landscape each spring. Larry passed a few years ago, but each spring when the daffodils bloom, I know his love still surrounds me." Next up in Reader's Digest, heart, a little more heart now. "A rare genetic condition is robbing these kids of their eyesight, so their family traveled around the world to give them a chance to see it all." Here's Lisa Fitterman with Vision Quest in Reader's Digest. His mouth open in both wonder and horror, Laurent Pelletier stares at the carnivorous armored bush cricket that has landed in front of him on the picnic table. He is camping with his family near Fish River Canyon in Namibia in Southwest Africa. The insect, yellow and light green, has a collar of spikes and six spindly legs planted in a boxer's stance. It's as big as the five-year-old's hand. "Can we eat it?" he asks his mom, Edith LeMay. "I don't think so," she says, laughing. "Then can I take it as a traveling companion?" "No, but you'll meet many more." And Laurent did, over and over again, during the first few months of a year-long trip through Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, with his mother, his father, Sébastien Pelletier, and his three older siblings, Mia, 12 years old, Leo, 10 years old, and Colin, 7 years old. Bush crickets, ground crickets, baby crickets, crickets whose chirping lulled them to sleep at night, the creatures became talismans, lucky charms on the family's journey around the world. Far from their home in Boucherville, Quebec, looking to imprint as many once-in-a-lifetime memories as they could rack up, they rode horses across the bright green steppes of Mongolia, kayaked on the azure sea off Cambodia, camped under the soaring brick-red peaks of Namibia, and flew in a hot air balloon over the brown, lunar-like landscape in Turkey. The memories really matter, because unless science makes a breakthrough soon, three of the four siblings, Mia, Colin, and Laurent, will become blind, likely in adulthood. The children have been diagnosed with a disease that has no effective treatment and no specific timeline, as it gradually robs them of their sight. The diagnoses came after a four-year search for the reason that Mia couldn't see at night. As a toddler, she banged into walls and furniture that her mom and dad could make out once their eyes adjusted to the dark. In the year 2013, when Mia was 3 years old, the family began a frustrating series of visits to doctors, none of whom had an answer for her lack of night vision. In the year 2015, as a last resort, a pediatric ophthalmologist enrolled the family in a research project in which their entire genome was mapped out. After two interminable years, the mapping was completed. At the ophthalmologist's office, the specialist gave it to them straight. Mia had retinitis pigmentosa, a mutation called PDE6B. She had inherited the gene from both parents, though neither had the condition nor knew that they were carriers. RP, as it is known, is a catch-all term for a group of about 50 inherited genetic mutations that affect the retina, tissue at the back of the eye that interprets images in black and white, and technicolor. The cells at its edges, called rods, crucial for peripheral and night vision, die first. As the disease progresses over years, the cells in the middle, called cones, used for seeing in color and for everyday activities like reading, writing, and driving, die off too. Right now, the doctor continued, there is no cure. Awash with emotion, Edith stood up, excused herself, and walked to the nearest bathroom, where she locked herself in a stall. Unwilling to lose it in front of Mia, who wouldn't understand, she sat there alone and cried. While it was tempting to seek a second opinion, Edith and Sebastian knew that genetic mapping did not lie. The results were definitive, irreversible, and life-changing. Later, tests would show that Colin and Laurent had PTE6B also. Only Leo dodged the mutation. Everything we hope for our children, for their future, for what they could become, has to change, Edith said to her husband one evening. How will they cope? They vacillated over explaining to 7-year-old Mia what her condition meant. Should they let her be a kid, innocent and unaware, for as long as possible? A few weeks later, it just came out, part of the conversation about disabilities in general while having lunch at their kitchen table. You know the problem with your eyes? Edith asked Mia. You're probably going to be blind when you're an adult. The revelation was more abrupt than Edith had hoped, but at least it was done. Edith held her breath as she waited for Mia to respond. Oh, that's not fun, the girl said before changing the subject. Later that week, Mia announced that she would need to start keeping her bedroom especially neat, with everything in its place. In the future, I'll need to know where things are, she said. Edith and Sebastian watched as Mia continued, unprompted, to feel her way around the house with her eyes closed, to see what it was like to navigate without sight, up the stairs and down, through the kitchen, living room, and basement, memorizing shapes with her fingertips. She's finding solutions on her own, they told each other. We need to follow her lead. And so the idea of a year-long trip was born, one that would show the kids the world in person and at close range, from windswept vistas to waterfalls and warthogs, a trip that would show life in all its grandeur and gritty detail, while the kids could still see it. When Edith and Sebastian first broached the idea in the spring of the year 2020, the kids didn't understand. A whole year away from home, from school, their grandparents and friends? It was too hard to imagine, says Leo. We'd gone away for a week or two at a time, but a year? I didn't think it was real. For the next 2 years, Edith and Sebastian worked, she in health logistics and he for a financial startup, and saved money. They researched places to visit and asked their children what they wanted to do on their big trip. Mia wanted to ride a horse. Colin wanted to sleep overnight on a train. Laurent thought it would be fun to drink juice while riding a camel. Leo wanted to tour Pokemon attractions in Japan. In early 2022, they were ready. Edith and Sebastian quit their jobs, rented out their home for the next year, and packed everything they thought they might need for a year on the go. Because the kids would miss more than 9 months of school, the plan was that they would study French and math a few times a week. The rest of the time, they'd be learning from the world around them, the best teacher of all. Traveling with 4 children wouldn't be cheap, but they'd save money by camping and staying in hostels, guest houses, and even a Mongolia yurt made from goat skins. On Monday, March 21st, they flew from Montreal to Windhoek, Namibia, with no set itinerary, save for a meandering initial trip from the southwest coast of Africa to the east, through Namibia, Botswana, and Tanzania. Once there, they would make plans on the fly. How we adults see the world and how kids see the world is so different, and we had to respect that, says Edith. That was clear from the start. It would have to be less about temples and museums and more about whatever caught their eye. Over the months, that world constantly revealed itself, sometimes in a cacophony, sometimes in a whisper. There was the shouting of hawkers selling bananas at each stop of the 24-hour train ride through Tanzania, and the near-cathedral silence of Namibia's 900-year-old dead vlei, or dead marsh. Once a marsh, it's now bone dry, with sand dunes rising 1,300 feet and trees that resemble black skeletons against a cloudless sky. The kids played patty cake with uniformed school children in Botswana and danced with Maasai tribesmen in Tanzania, where the family stayed on a banana farm. In Borneo, they went parasailing over the South China Sea. In Thailand, Mia touched an elephant at a sanctuary, calling out in surprise at how rough it felt. In northern Cambodia, Colin, who had always been more withdrawn than his siblings, mugged like a miniature pirate while brandishing the wooden sword a guide had carved for him on the spot from a piece of mahogany they'd found while hiking. Each day, Edith and Sebastian watched their kids change, physically and emotionally. Mia grew taller and, on the cusp of adolescence, needed more independence. Leo and Colin became more confident and outgoing, unafraid to engage with strangers, kick around a soccer ball with locals, and try new food. Even red ants in Laos gathered from under a tree. The verdict? They taste like lemons. The family grew more tight-knit and protective of each other, which helped when they faced situations that were difficult to explain. One example came when they drove past villages in Cambodia that were the sites of massacres, infamously known as the quote-unquote killing fields, during the genocide perpetrated by the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s. Their guide told of how he was abandoned as an infant in the nearby forest, likely hidden by his parents to protect him. In response, Edith and Sebastian held their children close to make them feel safe. Other times, the goal was fun and adventure, plain and simple, as when the family went up in a hot air balloon on July 1st to celebrate Laurent's 5th birthday. Or the visit in January to the Tad Phan waterfall in Laos, when the family buckled into a zip line and whipped across the gorge nearly 1,000 feet below. Rarely did they talk about why they were abroad in the first place, with one exception. While traveling along a dusty Mongolian highway last summer, Laurent asked, "What does it mean to be blind? How will I cross the street? Will my wife be blind? Will I be able to drive a car?" "It's like when you have your eyes closed," Edith said. "It won't happen overnight, but slowly, over years." Being blind, she told him, didn't mean the end of the world. Rather, the world would be different. Nothing would prevent them from doing most things, including skiing, swimming, or even becoming scientists who worked on cures for RP. Laurent nodded, then went back to making up games to pass the time. By the time the trip began to wind down in early 2023, the family had traveled 52,000 miles and visited 18 countries. The kids were very aware that they had learned about the world and themselves too, each expressing their experience in their own way. "There's a lot of suffering, a lot of poverty, but lots of good and interesting things too," said Colin. "Kids are kids everywhere, just like us, but maybe with their own customs and traditions." Leo's take was a bit less philosophical. "I am not fond of durian," he says, wrinkling his nose at the thought of the spiky fruit he tasted in Indonesia that smells like rotten eggs, old onions, and raw sewage combined. Mia said simply, "This has been a magic year we'll remember for the rest of our lives." Retinitis pigmentosa, which affects between 1 in 3,000 and 1 in 4,000 people globally, was once considered untreatable. But over the past 20 years, science has seen considerable breakthroughs. There is not yet a cure for PDE6B, the mutation that the Pelletier kids have, but thanks to genetic research, a surgical injection behind the retina can now reverse the effects of another mutation, RPE65. This, says Robert Kennecoop, a pediatric ophthalmologist in Montreal, has given science a clear roadmap for developing treatments for other forms of RP. Until then, science has managed to temporarily slow the progress of RP in many cases by injecting antioxidants such as vitamin A and omega-3 fatty acids at regular intervals. And in the year 2022, two different studies reported that acupuncture can improve vision, maybe through increasing the blood flow to the retina. Dr. Kennecoop says many of his patients who get acupuncture report that they can see better even at night. That lasts for a few months, and then they do the acupuncture again, he says. This is the most exciting time we've had in terms of advances for treatment of RP. The chances of kids like these three getting help are good. Edith and Sebastian know that there is hope, but they downplay the possibility because they want their kids to lead full lives, whether they're blind or not. The trip has reinforced what Mia showed them all those years ago when she wandered the house with her eyes closed. They will find their way and be happy. Today, my vision is good, and I'm going to make the most of it, says Mia. And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with a Reader's Digest classic from the August 1979 issue. Here's Bruce Felton and Mark Fowler from their book, Famous Americans You Never Knew Existed, Who Invented the Potato Chip? A Reader's Digest classic. Clarence A. Crane's principal business was chocolate, but during the hot summer months, it melted and sales fell off. So Crane developed a summertime specialty of hard mints and employed a local pill manufacturer to press the mints into shape. Because of trouble with the machinery, though, instead of plain round discs, the press stamped out little rings. Crane began marketing quote-unquote lifesavers in the year 1912. Since then, over 29 billion rolls have been sold. And this, by the way, is, remember, August 1979. In the year 1937, Sylvan N. Goldman of Oklahoma City invented the shopping cart. As owner of two supermarket chains, he was wounded to see customers head for the checkout counter after filling up only a basket. Today, next to the automobile, the shopping cart is the most widely used vehicle on four wheels, and the Smithsonian Institution has included an original cart in its collection. Anton Fechtwanger, a Bavarian immigrant, introduced the Frankfurter to America in the year 1904 in St. Louis. Fechtwanger could not afford to serve his sausages on plates with silverware. On the other hand, his customers couldn't eat them piping hot with their bare fingers. His first notion was to issue a pair of protective gloves with each Frankfurter, but too many people walked off with the gloves, and laundry bills were prohibitive. Then Fechtwanger came up with the idea of cradling his worst in a long sliced roll. This year, it's 1979, Americans will consume 84 francs for every man, woman, and child. In the year 1873, 15-year-old Chester Greenwood received a pair of skates as a Christmas present and eagerly rushed down to the pond to try them out. Chester had sensitive ears, and a few minutes later he was back in the house, his ears stinging fiercely. After several experiments with an assortment of headgear, he developed the perfect cold-weather earwear, two pieces of cloth attached to a semicircle of spring wire. Soon, Chester's mother and grandmother were busily turning out earmuffs for all of their neighbors in the little town of Farmington, Maine, and the young inventor was assigned patent number 188,292 for Greenwood's Champion Ear Protectors. Farmington became the quote-unquote earmuff capital of the world, and Chester Greenwood became a millionaire. The cocktail made its world debut in a small tavern in West Chester County, New York, in Revolutionary War days. The credit belongs to Betsy Flanagan, a barmaid who stirred the first cocktail with plumes from a neighbor's rooster. A group of officers were seated at the bar awaiting the drinks that Betsy mixed. As she served them, a Frenchman in the group proposed a toast, "Vive la cocktail!" And that is how the mixed drink got its name. It was George Crumb, an American Indian, who chipped the first potato. In the year 1853, Crumb was employed as a chef at a posh resort in Saratoga Springs, New York. One evening, a particularly fussy guest kept returning his French fries because they were, quote-unquote, too thick. Crumb grabbed a potato, sliced it into paper-thin pieces, and plunged them into boiling fat. The resulting golden, curling chips were proclaimed delicious by the stubborn diner. They were known as Saratoga chips until the turn of the century. Thereafter, they were called potato chips. Joseph C. Gaetti of New York gave the world toilet paper in the year 1857. Marketing it as Gaetti's Medicated Paper, a perfectly pure article for the toilet. Each piece was fashioned from an unbleached manila hemp paper and water woven with his name. A 500-sheet package was priced at 50 cents. Ernest A. Hamwi, a Damascus-born pastry vendor, obtained a concession to sell zalabia, a wafer-thin Persian waffle served with sugar or other sweets, at the St. Louis World's Fair in the year 1904. A nearby stand dispensed ice cream in small dishes. One summer day, the ice cream vendor ran out of dishes, so Hamwi took his hot zalabia, formed it into a cone, let it cool, and plopped a scoop of ice cream on top. The quote-unquote World's Fair cornucopia, later called the ice cream cone, was an immediate success. And finally, when President Theodore Roosevelt went to Mississippi in November of 1902 to help settle that state's running border dispute with Louisiana, he took the opportunity to get in a little bear hunting. The guide used hounds to corner an old lame bear, which he then roped to a tree, an easy trophy for the president. Roosevelt refused to shoot it. The incident inspired a newspaper cartoon. Morris Mictum, owner of a candy and toy store in Brooklyn, saw the cartoon and conceived the idea of creating a toy animal made of brown plush with movable limbs and button eyes. He put the finished plaything in the store window along with a copy of the cartoon and a sign reading Teddy's Bear. Mictum wrote asking Mr. Roosevelt for permission to use Teddy as a trademark. In a handwritten note, the president replied, "I doubt if my name will mean much to the bear business, but you may use it if you wish." By the year 1906, Mictum's Teddy Bear was the nation's best-selling toy. And before we go, we have time for a chuckle. Here's Life in These United States. Yefim F. Broad of Kirkland, Washington writes, "I was visiting a local art gallery when I noticed a middle-aged couple paused in front of a life-size painting depicting a beautiful naked woman with a cluster of leaves strategically placed around her body. The wife stated that the picture was in bad taste and moved on, not her husband, who stood gazing at the painting. 'What are you waiting for?' his wife demanded. He replied, 'Fall.'" You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.